Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States, Episode 5.6, Western Woes. I think it is fair of me to assume that all of you listening know the final fate of the Articles of Confederation. If you don't, well, spoilers ahead, but it isn't going to survive the decade. Of course, if you have been following along with the first five episodes of this season, none of that should be terribly shocking. It was abundantly clear to pretty much everybody, pretty much immediately, that the Articles simply were not cutting it. We have spent the majority of these first several episodes talking about the crippling financial crisis that was looming over everything. It truly is impossible to downplay how serious this crisis was, and really, it was indeed all-encompassing. When you don't have any money to pay any of the bills, everything else, regardless of how important it may be, feels like a secondary issue. We have seen this over our last two episodes, when we were looking at the disbanding of the Continental Army and the Newburgh Crisis. There were other underlying factors, but the lack of funds to pay the men really stood out as the paramount complaint. This week, we are going to, as much as possible, take a break from looking squarely at the issues surrounding the economy. Now, I say as much as possible because at the end of the day, most of the problems we are going to discuss circle right back around to the fact that the country was flat broke. But we're going to do our best. So, with that, for today, we are going to spend our time looking at some of the other problems facing the young country. Among the many consequences of the end of the war was that the United States ended up with a whole lot of land. Although the Americans had failed to fulfill their wildest dreams and secure Canada as part of the peace, they did manage to capture everything all the way out to the Mississippi River. The river itself would be open to both the United States and Britain for the sake of trade. Now, while this might all sound well and good, in reality, none of the European powers were terribly happy with how much land the new country had received. Nobody was exactly thrilled at giving such a wide swath of land to the United States. However, in the British interest of trying to divide the Americans from their French allies, the generous land rights between the Appalachians and the Mississippi River became the price to pay. This situation was going to cause a whole lot of headaches and annoyance from a lot of different parties. This situation is going to cause a whole lot of headaches and annoyance from a whole lot of different parties. So I'm going to march through some of these parties who had complaints and misgivings over the large land grant, because I think it gives us a greater amount of insight into how the government of the United States dealt with their problems during the Confederation era. The first of our aggrieved parties that I want to look at is the kind of, sort of, American ally, the Spanish. We have discussed at length that the Spanish, despite fighting on the same side of the war as the United States, never openly considered themselves to be allied with the United States. The situation was more akin to that old adage, that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The Spanish certainly did not care about the prospect of American independence, and indeed were fiercely opposed to the implications stemming from American independence. Rather, they were in it for the opportunity to poke Great Britain in the eye. For the Spanish, the prize was always to recapture Gibraltar. And to their credit, they tried really, really hard to make that happen. However, after a prolonged siege that dragged the war out longer than anybody was happy with, the British defeated the Spanish and retained their prized possession. The end of the war saw the Spanish regain their former possessions in West Florida, something that they had lost back during the French and Indian War. This was much to the chagrin of John Jay, who argued that the United States would be better off sharing borders with the British, as opposed to the Spanish. We talked back in episode 5.2 about how Jay losing on this point probably was an overall good thing for the future expansion of the United States. However, it does get to that key point. the United States recognized that the Spanish posed a real threat. As though to illustrate my point, the Spanish outright failed to recognize a large portion of the land that was ceded to the United States in the peace treaty. Specifically, the Spanish simply ignored that the United States held any rights over the lower Mississippi, closing it to the Americans in order to make that position well known. Now, to fully understand the breadth of the problems here, I want to step away from that problem that the Spanish had with the land claims ceded to the United States in the treaty, and look at one of the other, somewhat surprising parties that had plenty of headaches over this new expansive claim, the United States. Although it may seem counterintuitive, especially in the light that we are now mere decades away from the beginning of Manifest Destiny, a process that would see the United States expand across the continent, clear to the Pacific Ocean. In fact, today the United States can project its power into every nook and cranny of the globe, largely as a result of its massive economic power coupled with its gigantic military. The modern United States projects power in a way that few, if any, countries ever do. Arguably, the power that the nation has extends beyond the bounds of Earth and up into space. However, we have a very long way to go before we get to that point. In the 1780s, the United States was struggling to project power throughout its own frontier holdings. The further that you got from the safety of the Atlantic states, the less meaningful control the government was able to exercise. Making matters more complicated is the fact that this loss of control did not exactly do much to deter would-be settlers from flocking in droves over the Appalachians. Indeed, the population of the West was growing several times faster than the population of the original states. For those families that made the move there, there were all sorts of potential motivations. For some people, it represented a fresh start, a chance to get out of the seemingly overcrowded New England or the fiercely competitive Virginia, and to get somewhere where you could make a name for yourself. For others, it meant rampant land speculation and, hopefully, hefty profits. Still, for others, their reasons were not all that different from the first colonists. They wanted land and wealth and maybe just a splash of adventure. The western frontiers offered nearly endless amounts of land, and, with it, opportunity. The desire to move to the west was nothing new. In fact, in the aftermath of the French and Indian War, western expansion beyond the Appalachians and into the Ohio country became a serious concern for the British. It was enough of a concern that the king, largely codifying the agreements from the Easton Conference of 1758, issued the Proclamation Line of 1763. This line essentially forbade expansion into the Ohio country. The Proclamation Line was much maligned and, just as often as not, outright ignored. Although it is true that the Proclamation Line did have a cooling effect on migration into the interior of North America, it only slowed the process rather than stopping it. This line was one of the earliest salvos, and one that we often overlook during the imperial crisis. Now, with the United States having gained its independence, this was suddenly a problem that they were going to have to deal with. The problem is that in the 1780s, those lands were not exactly wide open for the taking. There were plenty of native tribes who strongly disagreed with the assertion that the western lands were uninhabited. Congress was not blind to this very real problem. They did what they could and made it illegal for those moving to the west to settle on lands being claimed by the Native Americans. Somewhat ironically, what they essentially did here is that they decided to pass their own version of the 1763 Proclamation Line that had so infuriated them 20 years earlier. Hypocrisy aside, it is not as though Congress had many options here. The last thing that the United States needed right now was an Indian war, and they were very motivated to prevent that from happening. The issue was that there was not exactly much Congress could do about it. The army, as we already know well by this point, had disbanded. Even if Congress wanted to seek the violent expulsion of the native tribes, They lacked the military might and the money to make it a reality. They had hoped that long-term, they could acquire the lands legally, allowing a more deliberate expansion, and hopefully avoiding the terror and the expenses that came from an Indian war. The impatient settlers, though, had little interest in waiting, and Congress had virtually no ability to stop them. This isn't to say that Congress did not at least make some attempts to enforce their mandate to stem the flow of migration, but rather, they lacked the ability to effectively achieve that end. In 1785, Congress attempted to send troops into Indian country to try and remove those in violation, people who were squatting on Indian lands. The troops cleared out the camps, burnt houses, and made sure that everybody knew that they were trespassing. The problem was that nobody really cared all that much, and the Confederation government lacked the ability to do much more about it. The mass migration towards the West would likewise create a substantial concern back within the Atlantic states over the real risk of depopulation. We have discussed before, but it is worth repeating, that state borders were something of a nebulous concept during the Confederation, especially as you moved further west. For certain states, Virginia and the Carolinas, for example, they claimed ownership over the new western lands. Said ownership meant that these states could sell off western land titles and make a tidy profit. For the New England states that did not have any kind of claim to these western lands, they were left with a two-pronged problem. First, these states felt like they were missing out on a large profit, and as a result, were forced to tax their citizens at a higher rate than those landed states to their south. The higher taxes meant that the New England states were more prone to that depopulation that came with a large number of their citizens moving to the West to escape that high tax burden. This is not to say that Congress did not at least try to control the frontiers, but really, they simply lacked the meaningful ability to project their power over them. Thomas Jefferson was the author of the Ordinance of 1784, which sought to lay out the groundwork for the operation of the frontiers, including laying out a plan to progress them from territorial status and then eventually to the status of states, co-equal with the original 13. The issue was that the existing states were largely jealous entities. The last thing that any of them wanted was for new states to enter the fray, which would then dilute their own power. With the very real risk of the population centers moving from the Atlantic states into the interior states in the West, there was a concern that, given enough time, the epicenter of national politics would shift westward. In 1785, Congress would pass a further ordinance to help control the process of just how land was to be surveyed and ultimately sold, attempting to strike a balance between competing state interests, as well as the interests and desperate need for funds from the national government. It was agreed that the lands would be surveyed and then subdivided into different uses. The land would then be sold off in chunks of at least 640 acres each. This did two things. First, it would slow down the entire process of people attempting to settle the western lands, something that Congress was desperate to do. The idea was that by taking time to survey, it would buy everybody a chance to settle things down a bit. The second effect of this is that it greatly favored the large landowners. 640 acre plus were not going to come cheap, and it effectively priced out individual landowners in favor of a more large-scale investment. A secondary issue also lingered here that, in time, would become one of the most pronounced features of American politics over the course of the next 75 years. With all this new territorial expansion came questions about the expansion of slavery. By the middle part of the 1780s, there were changes coming to the status of slavery within the states, changes that are going to help define the next century of American history. These are things that I'm planning on talking about in more detail in an episode down the road a little bit. However, already here in the middle part of the 1780s, there were questions about the status of slavery inside the territories. Thomas Jefferson had attempted in the Ordinance of 1784 to ban slavery in the Northwest. That provision was rejected. In 1785, it would be Rufus King of Massachusetts who agreed that slavery should be prohibited in the territories, something which Congress did not want to deal with. The southern states objected to any such attempts to stem slavery in the territories, which came much to the annoyance of the northern states where slavery was already an institution well in decline. This would prove to be a major problem when it came to the establishment of a system of governance over the western territories, and is one that would not be settled until after the Constitutional Convention of 1787. This, though, was only one such risk with a growing western frontier. You see, there really was a concern that as power shifted towards the west, it would pose a threat to the existing balance of power between the states. However, there was a secondary fear that was causing a fair amount of anxiety as well. What would happen if those people settling in the west decided that maybe they did not really need the United States? One way that this could potentially manifest itself would be a large group of settlers in those western territories just completely breaking with the United States and doing their own thing. This was not some far-fetched worry either. We have already seen threats to this effect. Recall that in the prelude to the events at Newburgh, Colonel Louis Nicola had made the suggestion that the army should just head off and make a new nation out in the West. Washington was very quick to pour cold water on the idea, but clearly, as early as 1782, there were those who were at least playing with the idea of separating from the United States entirely. George Washington certainly had his concerns about the loyalty of the West. During a tour of his vast holdings in the Ohio country in late 1784, one where he busied himself with suing squatters on his land, Washington became deeply concerned about the lack of anything linking those in the West with those back in the East. Now, his solution to this was a canal that would have seen the Potomac linked to the Ohio River. The stated reason is that such a project would tie the economies of the new Western territories together with the Atlantic states. As historian George Van Cleef points out, although this might have been the case, it is also difficult to look past the fact that Washington himself would have stood to make a very hefty profit from the success of such a project. Regardless of if Washington was looking to make a quick buck, he had a very good point. There really was very little tying the Western territories to the new national government. The United States lacked the means by which they could project power into the region. By the middle part of the 1780s, separationist groups were beginning to appear in various places, including in Kentucky, Tennessee, and parts of the Wyoming Valley. Although these machinations towards an independence movement stopped well short of becoming a more serious threat, it goes to show just how little ability Congress had in controlling the events, even within its own territories. Even the avoidance of a more serious separation crisis did not emanate from the policy decisions of the national government, but rather through agreements with the neighboring states. Kentucky's separationists were pacified when Virginia agreed to allow them to separate from any claims that the Old Dominion might hold over them. The Tennessee movement likewise was halted when those settlers ultimately decided to remain part of North Carolina. These movements towards separation with the United States came in part because Congress proved incapable of providing protection to the frontiers. With that in mind, let's loop back to one of those groups that was aggrieved by the land grants at the end of the war. Perhaps no one group had lost the American War of Independence more than had the Native American tribes. The majority of the tribes, although importantly not all the tribes, out to the Mississippi had allied themselves with the British. It was not exactly a decision that any of them liked, and my guess would be that many of the tribal leaders had figured out by this point that they were likely in a lose-lose situation. However, for many of those tribes, the British appeared to be the lesser of two evils. Therefore, when the Treaty of Paris was signed, and all that land out to the Mississippi was ceded to the Americans, it had to feel like a pretty major stab in the back. The tribes were very quick to point out that the land given to the United States was land that the British had no right to give away. It was already claimed. Realizing that they had been sold out by their supposed allies, many of the tribes throughout the American West did just about the only thing that they could. They found new allies amongst each other, against their common enemies. The British were still interested in a nominal alliance with the Indians, although it was more of a, let's say that we're allies, instead of the kind of alliance that comes with any meaningful promises. The hope was that the mere threat of an expanded British alliance with the tribes would be enough to act as a check on potential American westward expansion. Although it should be noted that although aid was seemingly minimal, that is not to say that there was none at all. Both the Spanish and the British did provide varying amounts of secret aid to the Native Americans. For the United States, all of this was deeply concerning. The last thing that they wanted to see was a more united coalition of tribes operating within their own territorial holdings. By the end of 1783, however, that was exactly what was happening. During the 1770s, historical enemies came together to support the British in the war. Following the outbreak of peace, these tribes, chief among them, the Shawnees and the Cherokees, met at a conference in Sandusky. It was there that so many of these tribes decided that the best course of action was to remain united, even in light of the British betrayal and their exit from the partnership. The leadership of the United States did what they could to try and break up these alliances, to little success. Really, the United States was in an extremely precarious position here. Thomas Jefferson had recommended that the strategy should be meeting with the tribes separately, at different places and times, rather than trying to deal with one unified group. This is exactly what the United States did during that period from 1784 forward, meeting with individual tribes. These meetings, always taking place in well-garrisoned U.S. forts, would generally see the commissioners forcing the Indians into terrible treaties to give up their land. To be sure, the Indians were not exactly ignorant of the American strategy of divide and conquer, but oftentimes there was little choice but to go forward with the deals. Neither side was particularly interested in a war right now. Neither the Americans nor the Indian tribes could afford such a general war. For the United States, a conflict akin to Pontiac's Rebellion would have been absolutely devastating. The army had disbanded following the revolution, and what remained now was really just a small token force. This is to say nothing of the fact that the United States was flat broke and couldn't afford to support an army anyway. The Native Americans, likewise, were not all that much more eager for a fight. The revolution had been brutal to them, and they had seen just how dangerous the Americans could be. As I said earlier today, no group had lost more during the war than had the Native Americans. Even those tribes, such as the Oneida, who did ally themselves with the United States, ended up being forced into these unenviable land deals. The peak of all of this came in 1784, in the form of a treaty signed at Fort Stanwix. This treaty saw the United States force the Six Nations of the Iroquois to give up their claim to power to much of the Northwest. If the United States wanted to pretend that they were going to treat fairly with the Indians, the Treaty of Fort Stanwix was anything but. This was a punitive action meant to punish the Indians for their alliances with the British during the war. This is not a modern interpretation either. Arthur Lee, who negotiated the treaty, was clear that the Iroquois were not an independent nation, but rather were a subdued people. Essentially, the Americans were making a somewhat vague claim that they were taking the lands under the right of conquest, although they never expressed any desire to govern over tribal affairs. They simply wanted a clear title to the land. One of the things worth noting here is that of the Six Nations, two of them had been allies of the United States during the war. Specifically, the previously mentioned Oneida, as well as the Tuscarora. Unfortunately, this did not seem to be a detail of any significant importance to the American commissioners. It is likewise important to understand that the Treaty of Fort Stanwix was not some sideways land deal, where the Americans bought up huge amounts of land at bargain basement prices. There was no trickery in the wording, like what we saw back in the infamous walking deal in the lead-up to the French and Indian War. There was no compensation to the tribes here. This was a pure and simple seizure. In the aftermath of the treaty at Fort Stanwix, the Iroquois did try their hand at taking a more aggressive approach towards the Americans. They spread stories that they had sent Joseph Bryant to England, and that he was very hard at work at securing an alliance against the United States. Interestingly, there was a kernel of both a truth and a lie to this. Despite the saber rattling from the Iroquois, Bryant did not actually travel to England in 1784 or 85. That was an attempt by the Iroquois to put pressure on the United States and to just generally stress everybody out. Now, the truth comes into play because in 1786, he did actually make the trip across the Atlantic to do the exact thing that the Iroquois had been pretending he had done the year before. The British were, at least on the surface, sympathetic to the cause of the Native Americans. They did provide some money and it looks like some weapons as well. But they simply could not risk another conflict in North America so soon after the last one. The Indians did attempt to flex some muscle, that their closer relationship to each other posed a serious risk to the United States. They made some demands that the United States abandon their claims of obtaining land titles out to the Mississippi. This flex had somewhat of the desired effect. The United States simply could not risk an event akin to the warfare seen during either the French or Indian War, nor during Pontiac's Rebellion. In both of those cases, the United States enjoyed the backing of the British, something that they certainly were not going to have this time around. A war would be expensive, which was a problem because the United States was broke, plus they had no army. Making matters worse, Congress desperately needed that money that would come from the sale of those western lands. However, that persistent risk of Indian violence had the effect of substantially depressing the value of those lands that the Congress so desperately needed to sell. There was little choice but to return to the drawing board and try to work out a deal that would pacify the tribes. In July 1787, Congress would acknowledge, through the Northwest Ordinance, that they did not lawfully own all the lands out to the Mississippi. The United States agreed to meet with the unified tribes, thus dropping the Jeffersonian strategy of trying to divide the tribes. All of this is going to lead full circle to help explain just what a difficult moment this was for the young nation. The Americans struggled to control the unwanted flood of people to the West and proved to be ineffective at removing them. In general, the settlers just did not really care much about the demands of the Confederation government to abandon their claims. They were doing everything that they could to both gain title from the Native Americans over those Western lands and establish their own legitimacy over the territory. Yet even as they attempted to gain control over this land, as they were in desperate need to begin selling it and turning some profit, they had to remain cognizant of that risk of triggering an unwanted border war with the Indians. The United States simply could not afford a general war in any sense with the Indians at this time. If there was a fear that the Western settlers may break with the United States and form their own country, there was likewise a concern that those same settlers may instead choose to defect over to another power. Now, the British at this time presented the United States with more of a nagging headache than any kind of a meaningful threat. Despite some hope that there would have been a normalization of relations following the end of the war, the British instead took a decidedly anti-American posture. In 1783, the British had taken the step of closing the ports in the Caribbean to American shipping. This was not necessarily a gigantic problem. It probably sounds worse than it was. As it turns out, if there is one talent the Americans had at this point, they were quite adept at shirking British restrictions, seeing as how they had a few decades' worth of experience at it. Despite this, though, the British were not really a serious threat to the United States at this point. After all, they had literally just lost a long war against the United States a few years earlier. They wanted to poke their former colonies, but they were not interested in doing anything more than annoying the Americans. Thus, we return to the beginning of our episode today. The much more serious risk in the West came from the former, nominal, ally of the United States, the Spanish. Again, the Spanish never fully recognized American gains in the West, and were none too pleased at the idea of sharing a border with their former, again nominal, allies. The Spanish were far more aggressive, at least on paper, at giving support to their Indian allies, and crossing their fingers that they would check American expansion. In the case of the Creek tribe, the Spanish entered into a lucrative trade deal that was mostly designed around the premise of the Spanish providing the Creeks with arms and ammunition. The Spanish had all the reason in the world to want to prevent a powerful United States from forming in the West. They feared that if the United States properly utilized the Mississippi River, it would threaten critical trade networks with Spain's own American colonies. As discussed earlier, Spain's chief minister, Count Florida Blanca, responded by closing the river to American shipping. It was not lost on the Spanish that such an act might not be viewed in a positive light by the United States, and it wasn't. However, the hope was that a trade could be reached whereby the United States would relinquish any claims over the river, while the Spanish would agree to enter into a trade agreement with the U.S. The Americans were, more or less, caught completely off guard by this development. Historian George Van Cleef points out that it is actually a bit surprising that the Americans were caught so flat-footed. After all, they had been present in Paris during the peace negotiations, and were well aware that both the Spanish and the French had an interest in hemming in the U.S. Throughout 1785, a general consensus quickly spread that the United States needed to find some way to secure their rights over the river. Perhaps fittingly, the man who was chosen to negotiate was John Jay. As mentioned earlier today, Jay was always looking side-eyed at the Spanish, and had gone so far as to suggest that a British presence in Florida was preferable to a Spanish one. Now, Jay was being sent to treat with the Spanish diplomat, Don Diego de Gardoqui. The overriding goal for John Jay was the reopening of the Mississippi River. The overriding goal of Gardoqui was keeping the river closed to American shipping. Gardoqui, in this role, did a fantastic job of understanding John Jay. In addition to offering a critical trade agreement, Gardoqui quickly figured out that the fastest way to John Jay's heart was through unabashed flattery. Through an extensive program of gift-giving, both to Jay and people who may be sympathetic to the Spanish position, Gardoqui was able to convince the Americans that the proposed trade deal might be worth sacrificing the Mississippi. This is what Jay proposed during the spring of 1786. The proposed deal did come with a few problems, though. Although exceptionally beneficial to New England, the further south you moved, the less the trade alliance provided. Interestingly enough, both those who were in favor of and opposed to the treaty pointed to the risk of the Western settlers eventually falling under the control of the Spanish. In Massachusetts, Rufus King wrote to Elbridge Gerry of his feelings that by closing access to the Mississippi, it would hinder the ability of the Western settlers to become completely self-dependent, and that by cutting off the Mississippi, it would force the Western settlers to remain tied to the Atlantic states. On the other hand, James Monroe wrote to James Madison that he believed closing the Mississippi would so seriously alienate those living in the West that they would be forced into the hands of foreign powers. Both sides were clearly worried about the prospect of the Spanish eventually annexing the Western territories. Although, probably not surprisingly, their methods of preventing such an eventuality seemed to hinge on the benefits that their state was deriving from the proposed trade agreement. George Washington was one of the few who actually took a more measured approach here, arguing that the timing probably was not right to outright provoke the Spanish. However, in time, the natural growth of the West would essentially force the Spanish to give Americans navigation rights over the Mississippi. Eventually, there would not be anything that Spain could meaningfully do to prevent it. Others, especially in the South, took a far more aggressive stance, going so far as calling for outright war. Making matters even worse, for many living in the West, they saw the Northern states' support of Jay's plan as an outright betrayal. Everybody in Congress was fully aware that a war with Spain was just a terrible idea. It was the very last thing that any of them wanted, largely because the country could not afford it. Armies cost money. The United States had no money. It is a pretty fair bet that should the United States and Spain go to war, the French were not going to eagerly bankroll the Americans in a fight against one of their closest allies. John Jay, arguing before Congress, essentially pointed out that the country was not in a place to provoke a war against Spain, and that the best bet was to get what they could out of a bad situation. In this case, agreeing to giving up rights over the river in exchange for that favorable trade agreement. The debates over the proposed treaty raged, with both sides predicting that issues over this agreement could well lead to the dissolution of the Confederation. It was not lost on anybody that certain factions, specifically New England and, to a lesser degree, the Mid-Atlantic states, were getting far more out of the treaty than were the Southern states. This growing regionalism had the states looking out for themselves at the expense of the greater Union. Not only were debates over the treaty now stalling out, but calls both in the North and the South for secession from the Confederation began to grow louder. Here, in this highly charged moment, the Northern states decided to just go for it and shove the treaty through, and cross their fingers that Southern threats of secession were just that, threats. The final vote was pushed through and came down completely along sectional lines. The instructions to John Jay is that he could agree to the closure of the river for a period of 25 to 30 years. Even the vote itself was fraught with confusion, though. Normally, the ratification of a treaty required 9 votes, meaning that the final 7-5 vote in favor of the treaty should not have been enough to push it through. The Northern states argued that they were not actually ratifying a treaty here. They were simply voting on if they should amend Jay's instructions. This argument over parliamentary procedure just further stroked those feelings of mistrust between the states. Rifts had been exposed as to the serious sectional differences between the states. For the first, but certainly not the last time, this rift between the Northern and Southern states had been put on full display for everybody to see. This battle over the rights of the West would likewise show how weak the Confederation really was and just how little power they had to project their own influence right into their own backyard. The vote had come in August of 1786, and by this point everybody could see just how ineffective the Articles of Confederation truly were. Following the vote for Jay's treaty, an increasing number of political leaders began questioning the viability of not just the Articles of Confederation, but the Union as a whole. Next time, the wheels begin to come off as the Articles of Confederation enters into its death throes. The country was broke. It was unable to project power even into its own territories. The government was inefficient to the point of being barely functional. And now the states were questioning if they even wanted to remain in a union with each other. Until then, I hope you all have a wonderful 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as the Confederation government begins to collapse.